The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2014. Here's books editor Claire Armitstead.
Hello and welcome to the second of our Edinburgh Book Festival podcasts. Our subject today has become something of an international stadium star, which is to say he's George R. R. Martin. And he walked onto the main stage to the sort of ovation that's more familiar to Glastonbury audiences than to your average Edinburgh crowd. We're in the signing queue now. There's a camera boom hanging over the great man in the marquee in the distance. But I have in front of me two young fans. How did you find it?
It was really good, yeah.
He was really great about answering questions. He's great responses, and he really took his time to answer questions really fully. It was great, yeah.
He says in the session that he wants people to remember him, as that he is the writer of the novels, not of the television show. How did you come to them first?
I heard about the TV show and I heard about the books. I'm a bigger fan of books than TV, so I went straight and read the books. And then after, I saw the TV show and I completely enjoyed the books. I'd say more, but the TV show is fantastic as well.
I was recommended them by him, actually. He read the first one and then he recommended them to me. I prefer the books, yeah.
And now over to George R.R. himself.
You know, I do have quite a long body of work that predates Ice and Fire. I started writing Game of Thrones in 1991, but I sold my first story in 1971. So there are 20 years of other books, science fiction, horror, occasional fantasy, short story, that predate Ice and Fire. But I am startled by the fact that I swear at least half my readers think that I came out of nowhere with A Song of Ice and Fire, and they know nothing of the other work. So I'm always trying to encourage people to read the other work. You know, I don't tend to think of precursors or themes. I mean, when I focus, I'm just telling one individual story, and that's the story I want to tell. But certainly, there are periods of your life where you're obsessed with certain things that have affected you that you're thinking about at that stage of your life. And again, if you take the long view, you can see my early work in the 70s was predominantly science fiction. It was, I think, a particularly romantic blend of science fiction. Mm. In the early 80s, I started writing some horror stories. And then I started mixing and matching, which I always thought was interesting. I like to break the rules. And you can certainly see that in my fantasy, but you could also see it in some of these earlier works I did, like Sand Kings, which is a science fiction story, but is also a horror story. Night Flyers, same thing. You know, I was reading a lot of critical studies by then by people who were... Horror was becoming very popular in the 80s, and science fiction was waning a little, and there were some critics pontificating about, oh, these are two very different genres, because, you know, science fiction represents the intellect and the knowable universe, and horror represents a universe, an inimical universe beyond our control. So the two can never mix, because they're polar opposites. So I promptly said, well, I'll show him. I'll mix them up. And come up with something that's both a good science fiction story and a good horror story. So I always have that sort of impulse to try to do things that they say can't be done.
Martin has been described as the American Tolkien because of the way he uses history to weave his tales. He has a keen affinity with Scottish history in particular, partly through his reading of Sir Walter Scott. So he has made several previous visits.
I've visited Scotland probably about a half dozen times now over the years. The first time was in 1981. I know my dear friend and sometime collaborator Lisa Tuttle is here in the audience. There she is. And she although actually a Texan, moved to England initially a number of years ago in the late 70s. And in 1981, I visited her. And we traveled all over in England, and then we went up to Scotland driving. And we did hit Hadrian's Wall one day in 1981, which was 10 years before I even started writing this. But we got there right at the end of the day, all the tour buses had left. It was near sunset, and we were climbing up on the wall just when everybody else was leaving. And I remember standing there. It was like October. It was a cold day, not quite as cold and gray as this day is in August, but still pretty cold and gray. And I stood on that wall and stared off into Scotland. Well, I guess it's not Scotland anymore. It was Scotland once upon a time, but
Scottish.
Yes. And tried to think what it was like to be a Roman legionary from, southern Italy or Greece or even North Africa who had been posted there at the end of the world. And it was sort of a profound feeling. I have to capture this in a book. But fantasy is always bigger. So when it came time to write the books, I made the wall, 100 times as high and much longer and made it of ice, which would be much cooler. I personally think if Scotland does secede, the first thing you should do is build a gigantic wall of ice between Scotland and England. It would be a great tourist attraction, and and then you could keep the English out if you wanted.
It was after that visit that he began his best-selling series, Song of Ice and Fire, which has now been transformed into the TV series Game of Thrones. His work is now known for being bloodthirsty.
Scottish history is very bloody, but then so is most of history. I mean, what was different for me about Scottish history was that it's extensively chronicled, and it's chronicled in English. You know, I've traveled as a child and a young man. We were poor. We never went anywhere, so I had a very limited world. But I've traveled fairly extensively since the 80s in my adult years, and I find myself in countries that have great histories, particularly medieval histories, which is my particular area of interest, but the books have never been translated into English. You know, so I'll be in Germany or Czechoslovakia or Romania, and I'll see some great book about the medieval history of Romania, but it won't be in English, and I don't unfortunately read Romanian, so these things are denied me. But English history and Scottish history, to a lesser extent French history, is of course very well chronicled, and I've read a ton of it. I don't think it's particularly bloody than some of these other areas of the world. It's just I have more access to it. History, particularly medieval history, is really written in blood, as I've said more than once. We've done some appalling things down through the centuries to each other, and as bloody and terrible as our modern times are, I do think if you look at it, if you take the long view and go all the way back to the ancient times, there is some moral evolution going on. The human race is making progress. It may be painfully slow, so in the individual human lifetime, you don't necessarily see the progress that you would like, but in the long view, it's pretty discernible.
Now there's a surprisingly hopeful outlet from this weaver of horrific fantasy. It all began to fall into place when he told us where his love of stories began.
I began when I was a kid. As a comic book fan, I read a lot of comic books, and the first words of mine that were ever published were in Marvel Comics, a Fantastic Four letter column, Fantastic Four number 20, a letter of praise about Fantastic Four number 17, where basically I said, Shakespeare, move over, Stan Lee has arrived. And I published a number of letters in the Marvel letter columns of that age. One of them, the comedian John Hodgman came up to me with a Xerox of one at a Hollywood event, and it was a letter I'd written to the Avengers about the issue in which the character of Wonder Man was first introduced, and I just loved it. I mean, the letter was a complete praise of this brilliant issue. Now, those of you who are not comic book geeks here, you know, the Avengers, you know all the Avengers, right? You've seen the movie, even if you didn't read the old comic books like I did in the day. So Wonder Man is this character who comes in, and he joins the Avengers. He's this great hero. He's really powerful. He joins the Avengers, but he's secretly a bad guy who's been planted in the Avengers to destroy them from within. But when the moment comes where he's supposed to betray them and destroy them, he's come to like them so much by being a spy among them that he can't bring himself to do it. Instead, he sacrifices himself and dies at the end of the issue. And of course, I love this. Even at the age of 12 or 13 or whatever it was, everything about this issue appealed to me. And I look at it and say, well, there's my literary influence right there. It's Stan Lee. It's this great character who's, you know, you think he's good, but really he's evil. But at the end, he's really good. But then he gives up his life and he dies for it. Of course, they ruined it by bringing him back in later issues. But but at the time I wrote the letter, I didn't know that I thought he died. So, you know, so maybe Stan Lee is the greatest literary influence on me, even more than Shakespeare or Tolkien or Sir Walter Scott or any of them.
And that gives us a clue to what readers love about Martin's characterization, that it's not simply black and white.
In some sense, you're always in dialogue with the writers who go before you. And, you know, in my case, people have called me the American Tolkien. They've cited this thing. And Tolkien, of course, was an enormous influence on me. It's still a book that I revere, Lord of the Rings. I reread it every few years. I first read it when I was 12 or 13 years old. It had an enormous effect on me. So in some sense, when I started this, I was replying to Tolkien. But even more so, I think I was replying to the Tolkien imitators who had followed him. You know, I think modern genre fantasy, of course, goes all the way back to as long as literature existed. I mean, you can, the Iliad, the Odyssey, Epic of Gilgamesh, all fantasies, but modern fantasy really begins with Tolkien, the secondary world fantasy that he made so popular. And that was followed in the 70s and 80s by a legion of Tolkien imitators who, to my mind, took a lot of the elements that Tolkien used but cheapened them. And didn't really think about them. And there was this hunger for more stuff like Tolkien, I think, on the part of the audience. But they were being sold, you know, degraded goods here. And I, reading them, at least glancing at some of them, the thought of, no, this is not how it should be done. This is all wrong, you know, fastened itself in my head. There was the Disneyland Middle Ages, as I've referred to in some other talks I've given, where the writers were taking the whole structure of medieval times with castles and knights and princesses and all that, but they were writing it from a very modern 20th century American or perhaps British point of view, and it was more like a Renaissance fair than actual medieval times. And if you read somebody like Nigel Tranter or Thomas B. Castaigne, another great historical novelist, even the classics like Sir Walter Scott, you get a much more feel for what the Middle Ages actually was than the Disneyland thing. So I wanted to combine, just as I had combined science fiction and horror with stories like Sand Kings, I wanted to combine the wonder and the imagination of the traditional Tolkienist fantasy with the grittiness and the realism of the best historical fiction.
I mean, for me, one of the things I do like about, for me, my perspective is the history and the way he does that and uses the history to create the stories. And it does get people. I have friends that are uni students that are interested in new periods of history that have chosen their history courses based on it because they got very interested in that period. So I think it goes past just being another fantasy drawing on the Celtic.
How does it compare to sort of his predecessors, people like Tolkien?
Well, no one tops Tolkien. I think a lot of people really like it because it is almost as involved, and just the world that he's created, he obviously puts so much into it, you know. Where Tolkien also, like, you know, he just created this really intense world that you can completely lose yourself in, and I think George Martin does the same thing, where it's really easy to get into the characters' heads and to see their motivations and, like, the way the whole world is laid out is, I mean, astoundingly detailed.
And there are definitely similarities between the two, because if you look at Tolkien and the medieval literature and the way he drew on the literature and that you can trace that through his works, it's very similar to what Martin has done with the history. So they're similar in that way, but I think other than that, that'd be sort of
the only... They're
very different with what they do with their characters as well.
So do you think of it as the Game of Thrones or...
A Song of Ice and Fire. But I actually started reading them because I had friends who were watching Game of Thrones first season. And like, sir, you need to watch this. I'm not a big TV watcher. So I went out and got the books and started reading those.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
We spoke about the historical influence on your books, but I was wondering, are there any characters or personalities in the books that are based off of real people from your personal life?
You know, a lot goes into a character. I've read a lot of history. Obviously, The War of the Roses has been a huge influence on a lot of the Game of Thrones. The Lannisters and Starks, Lancasters and Yorks, sure, that's pretty easy to make, but there's no one-to-ones. You can look at Robert, and there's a lot of Edward IV in him, but there's also a bit of Henry VIII, and there's also a bit of Falstaff, and, you know, there's a lot of people I know and so forth. So you try to build original characters by borrowing from history but not copying history. For the viewpoint characters, you know, I really have to look into myself, and not to get too existential here, but, you know, we're all trapped alone in our heads here, and whatever we may think we know other people, we only know their words. We don't have telepathy, unless it's in, like, one of my science fiction stories. So we really don't know, when we have to try to plumb our own motivation, our own depths, our own dreams and desires and dark impulses, and to make a character come alive when you're inside his skin, that's the kind of stuff you have to do. Now, I'm asked sometimes how I can say I'm drawing on my own experiences when, in fact, I've had no experiences like that, and that's certainly true. I've never been an 8-year-old girl. I've never been an exiled princess. I've never been a dwarf. But I have been a human being, and all these people are human beings, too. I think, you know, the distinctions about how do you write a woman or how do you write a dwarf are artificial distinctions. I mean, yes, there are differences between men and women, but there are small differences compared to the things that we have in common, our common humanity. Yes, a dwarf has different life experiences than a person who's 6 foot tall, but they also have the same kind of desires and dreams, a desire for love and for respect and to leave a mark on the world. These are kind of basic human things that certainly I feel, and I think all people feel. And that's what I try to capture with some particular twist and understanding of where that character is coming from. I am attracted, and I think it's reflected in these books, to, you know, bastards, cripples, and broken things, as it said. A great many of the leading characters in A Song of Ice and Fire are people who do not fit comfortably into the society of which they're a part, who are outcasts or at least second-class citizens for one reason or another, because they're female in a patriarchy, because they're a bastard in a society that puts a lot of emphasis on true birth, on bloodlines, because they're a dwarf or a cripple or what have you. Not all the characters like that, but certainly many of the characters are like that, because I think there's more drama in characters like that. They have more to struggle with, and conflict is the heart of drama and good fiction.
He's also good at creating female characters, which might explain why so many women are among his fans.
Some of the queens of Scottish history, from Lady Macbeth on down, were strong women who didn't necessarily put on chainmail bikinis and go forth to fight in battles, but exercised immense power by other ways. Mary, Queen of Scots, was an idiot, but certainly a strong-willed woman, and she ran up against an even stronger and rather smarter woman and came out on the losing end there. But still a fascinating character in her own way and the struggles that she went. And some of her predecessors, some of the other Scottish queens who ruled as regents for, you know, those of you who know your Scottish history know that Scotland kept getting stuck with like 3-year-old kings, and these long periods of regencies where all the lords would fight over the regency, and usually the queen was in the middle of that. So, you know, I did want to reflect different types of women. I mean, one of the things that I have a great advantage of is with my cast of characters, because I have so many characters that in something like Writing Women, I can have strong women and weak women. I can have noble women and selfish women. I can have smart women and stupid women, which is the true of any group, I think, and is the way to, because we're all different. I mean, your problem comes when you stereotype a group as all being kind of the same, and especially if you give them negative characteristics, when actually all groups that I know of, and yes, we're influenced by our culture, and there are certain cultural similarities, and we fulfill certain societal roles, but the individual differences are very important, and we get very different personalities, even within the same culture and society, and I try to reflect that.
The basis of Martin's huge success is his skill at plotting. He's an expert at creating cliffhangers, and part of the pleasure for his fans is to try to predict what will happen next. They've got so good at it, he confided, that he's given up trying to prove them wrong.
I've wrestled with this issue because I do want to surprise my readers. I hate predictable fiction as a reader. I don't want to write predictable fiction. I want to surprise and delight my reader and take the story in directions they didn't see coming. But you can't change the plans. I used to read some of these fan boards back in the 90s and the early aughts when they were new, and then I stopped doing that because, well, for a variety of reasons. One is I didn't have the time. Two is this very issue of so many readers were reading the books with so much attention, and they were throwing up some theories, and a lot of the theories were amusing bullshit, but very creative. But some of the theories were right. You know, the readers, at least one or two readers, had correctly put together the extremely subtle and obscure clues that I'd planted in the books and came to the right solution. So what do I do then? Do I change it? And I wrestled with that issue. And I think changing it would have been a disaster. I mean, because the clues were there. I'm planting all these clues that the butler did it. And then you're halfway through the series, and suddenly thousands of people have figured out that the butler did it. And you say, okay, the chambermaid did it. Well, you got all these clues that are pointing at the butler that somehow you have to retroactively deal with or something. No, you can't do that. So I'm just going to go ahead, and some of my readers who don't read the boards, of which thankfully there are still hundreds of thousands, will still be surprised, and other readers will say, see, I said that 4 years ago. I said the butler did it. I'm really smarter than you guys. And that's just the way you have to do it here.
I started reading the books when I heard about the series, but very quickly overtook. And they're one of the first books I found where reading them on ebook, I've actually preferred to a physical book, because you can just instantly go on to the next one, which I found at the end of each volume. I couldn't have waited the hour to get to the bookshop to buy the next one to then come back. Just certain characters strike you as somebody who's very real, whereas others are a little bit more fantastical. Yeah. Warlocks, for example.
Adds a bit of a curveball to the sort of history that we can relink to the story. And then you get the dragons, you get the magic, which sort of makes it a bit more mysterious and, you know, anything could happen, really.
The fact that it started off quite grounded in reality, just with the human families, and then gradually started to add the more fantastical elements, it's quite nice. It eases you in a way that other fantasy series maybe don't. He's built it up like a 700-foot-high wall at the edge of the world to something that's completely else, but with still with these relatable characters in the centre of it.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.